Welcome to Law Talks. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Law Talks is a series of podcasts on international human rights law. It's produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative of the Open Society Foundations. Our guest in today's edition is Darian Pavli, an expert on freedom of information litigation here at the Open Society Justice Initiative. Darian says that the right to information has achieved increased global recognition over the past two decades. It's now a rapidly emerging area of human rights law. Right-to-know litigation is being used by local groups around the world who are involved in issues including the environment, government corruption, and the protection of personal rights. So, Darian, to begin with, can you just give us a big picture of where these laws came from? I mean, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s in Britain, the notion of Freedom of Information Acts or legislation wasn't really common. So now lots of countries have these acts. And where do they come from?
Right. Well, in some ways, they go back a long way. The first Freedom of Information Act is from the Swedish Constitution of the 1700s, the second half of the 1700s. But in other ways, they are a product of a remarkable development in international law. They are, in a sense, one of the youngest rights in what we call the Universal Bill of Rights. And there has been a certain explosion, especially in the last 20 years. In 1991, when the Berlin Wall had just come down and there was a democratic revolution underway in Eastern Europe, there were only about a dozen freedom of information laws around the world. By now, there are more than 90 jurisdictions around the world that have freedom of information laws, and there are something like 4 billion people, someone went through and calculated the numbers, that live now in countries and jurisdictions with right-to-know laws. And just to clarify what we mean by that, because, of course, the right to seek information, the right of individuals to request and impart and look for information at the so-called sort of horizontal level among themselves is a cherished and traditional right. It's part of what we call free speech and free expression. What we mean specifically by freedom of information is the right to seek and obtain information that is held by your government, by public authorities generally. And in a way, what's interesting about this explosion in the recognition of the right, which has coincided, of course, with the democratic revolutions of the past 20 years, including most recently in the Middle East. For example, one of the first things that democracy activists in Egypt and Tunisia are pushing for is freedom of information laws. But what is remarkable about this sort of development of the law and the jurisprudence in the last 20 years is that, in a way, it has overturned this absurd but long-standing assumption that the government sort of owned its information, and it was for the government to decide how much and under what circumstances they wanted to give us information, which they collect using taxpayer resources. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, the government should be of the people and for the people. So in a way, it's sort of an original sin of government that we did not have this right to have as broad access as possible. There have to be some secrets, but the broadest possible access and a presumption that information held by the government should, as a principle, be in the public domain. We did not have that 20 years ago. We only had that in a few countries. Now that principle has been firmly established in at least three or four regions of the world, both at the national level and then the international level.
So what's the role of litigation in this? If the government agrees a law, we all lobby to get the law passed, then it's passed. Where does the litigation come in?
Right. I mean, there is always at least two dimensions to that. You have the national level and then you have the international level. And they interact, of course. At the national level, One thing that is specific about freedom of information is that it is a positive right. And in that sense, it is different from the traditional free speech. Traditional free speech is the right to speak up your mind and for the government to stay away from that, to be left alone in speaking up your mind, in other words. Freedom of information is more of an active right. The government has to do something to provide it. They have to take active steps to, you go and ask for something, they have to look for it, they have to figure out what it is that you're looking for, they have to put it together, they have to provide it. And so it requires a certain machinery, but most of all, it requires a change in the mindset, in the bureaucratic culture. There's usually, whenever you have a new freedom of information law, there's a remarkable degree of resistance most of the time.
People just don't want to give the information up, even though the law says they should.
Right. It goes back to that assumption that that way of doing things, that government knows best, and it's no one's business to sort of pry into what's in their drawers. At the end of the day, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but a very true one. Information is power, and that's the whole point about giving this right to the people. And the bureaucracy knows that, the more information is out there about what they do or don't do and how they do things, the more exposed they are to accountability. And so that's where litigation can be very useful in sort of helping to break that resistance and turn that culture on its head and sort of ultimately persuade the public officials, the bureaucracy, that their world will not be turned upside down.
So that first level of litigation would be at the national level.
Right.
Then is there anywhere that litigants can go? How can they go beyond that? If the government says, no, this law isn't interpreted in this way, you're not allowed that information. Is there, what other resources are there?
Well, in many parts of the world, it is possible to go to the international level. And in other words, to challenge the decisions of your government or your domestic courts. And that's been always a big part of promotion of human rights. But it also works the other way around, which is if you have a ruling at the international level, like we've had recently several groundbreaking ones in the area of the right to know, then that helps activists at the domestic level. For example, you live in a country that doesn't have a right to know law because there is no political will and resistance from the administration and various sectors. And so if you have a ruling from an international court that can help you push for adoption or a proper law, at least recognition of the right to know by your local courts in some fashion. And, for example, a good illustration of that has been a decision of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which is one of the three leading regional human rights mechanisms in the world, together with the European and the African system. So the Inter-American Court in 2006, for the first time in history of international law, in a case against Chile involving a request for access to environmental information, the court used that case to find that there is in the human rights treaty of that court, the American Convention, a right, a new right, you might say, of a fundamental right of access to government information in international law. And what's remarkable about this, apart from the fact that you don't get new right in your Universal Bill of Rights every other day, is that the court considered this to be as fundamental as free speech, as part of the one of the elements of the right to free speech, and as a right that is essential to political participation in a modern democracy. And why that's important is that what follows from that is that that judgment, just by virtue of the court's declaration, has granted this new right to every citizen, every person who lives in a country under the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Court. They have to do something about it now. They have to guarantee these rights in their everyday operations.
Can you tell us a little more about that specific case?
It started. It is a remarkable story because it started from a single researcher and an activist dedicated to environmental issues in Chile. Filed a request for information with a Chilean agency.
This is Claude Reyes.
His name is Claude Reyes. And what happened in that case is that he, you know, there was a certain outcry in the Chilean public debate about the fact that an American company with a dubious environmental record had obtained rights for logging activities in the south. It's a fragile environment, and so this company with very little publicity or public debate obtained rights to exploit this environment, and the Chilean authorities, not recognizing a right of access, simply denied the request of Mr. Claude Reyes, Marcel Claude Reyes, that's his full name, and basically ignored it. And so local lawyers and activists took up his case and fought it through the domestic tribunals. It took several years. Then they took it to the Inter-American system, another several years. And that's how we have today. I mean, a lot of other people were involved with the case, including the Justice Initiative. We filed two amicus briefs with the commission and the court and worked with the local lawyers to develop the strategy. But at the end of the day, I have a sort of a mental image of having sat in the hearing before the Inter-American Court Marcel Claude sitting there holding hands with his wife as the judges were questioning the director of the same agency that had, you know, ignored or dismissed his original request for information. And it was a very uncomfortable position for this man because he was sent there to argue that it was actually his sort of individual mission and not the Republic of Chile's responsibility. But what one took from it was there's something very empowering. It's the whole information is power business. There's something very empowering about being able for him to sit there and have an international tribunal or a local tribunal for that matter tell the government, you know what, these people have the right to know what you're up to. These are your voters, your taxpayers. They're entitled to know what you're up to if someone is going to do logging in thousands of hectares in their country.
That was it in action. So that case got passed or got won at an international level. What kind of litigation has that led to subsequently?
Well, there's an entire sort of progeny of Claude Reyes in Latin America, for example. We have been involved in a couple of those cases, but then other groups have brought cases on their own. Just to give an example, Paraguay doesn't recognize right of access yet. They don't have anything in the Constitution that guarantees the right to know. They don't have a law. They've had a bill pending in Parliament for several sort of legislatures now, and there hasn't been enough political will. And so what happened in that case, local lawyers and activists started filing requests and litigating them in the courts in the hope of getting the political system is not working, is not willing to recognize. So they're trying to work their way through the judicial system and to try to get the courts of the country to recognize that there is a right to know. Because as I said, under the American Convention, I mean, that's the beauty and the potential of international litigation. The country now is required to guarantee in whatever way they see fit that their citizens enjoy this right to know that the Inter-American Court has developed. And so there's a case now pending before the Supreme Court of Paraguay. The Justice Initiative put in another what's known as a friend of the court or an amicus brief. And it started from a similarly simple request.
And what was the request in that case?
The request in that case was a local citizen who likes to get involved in public affairs, filed a simple request for the titles and salaries, or at least the salary scales of officials in the local municipality.
Very sensitive information.
in some ways, but also in lots of places. It is in that particular locality in Paraguay, and the reason why these gentlemen requested the information was because there were all sorts of allegations in the media that the mayor was hiring his buddies and his relatives as advisors and consultants, and there was a whole number of consultants who were not technically on payroll, but they were getting large sums of money for dubious activities. And it's, again, the kind of potential and the kind of power that being entitled to request information from the government gives the citizenry. It was denied. The information was denied on privacy grounds, personal privacy grounds. Even there were public officials, and in some ways bizarre, because you can't say that the titles of private officials, public officials, for example, are protected by privacy. We should. If these people are running the city's business, one should know at least what they're doing or what they're supposed to be doing.
And so that's advancing through the Paraguayan courts and moving on?
It's currently pending before the Supreme Court of Paraguay. And of course, now that the Inter-American Court has recognized the right, there are good hopes about which way the judgment will come out. But if it doesn't come out the right way, then the local lawyers will certainly go to the Inter-American system. There have been similar cases in Chile and in Peru. Peru is another country in which we've been involved with another sort of friend of the court intervention. And the issue in Peru was about access to the asset declarations of public officials. They're required by law to provide these asset declarations to some government agency, but they're not fully public. And so if the government doesn't do something with it, there's no public accountability. There's no way for civil society groups, the general public, to try and monitor corruption in government to find out about officials who are living beyond their means, let's say.
Right. And right-to-know legislation can often be an important tool in fighting corruption. I think that's one of the reasons a lot of excitement about it in the law being passed in Nigeria last year. But presumably it affects other things as well.
Anti-corruption is a huge drive. And perhaps it's in the way it fits with the current democratic concerns throughout the world. Corruption is one of the major issues of the day. And in many places, groups have found amazing ways to use freedom of information law to fight corruption in its various forms. India is an excellent example that is often brought up for a good reason. There have been lots of stories and studies about how groups, and these are include disadvantaged, traditionally marginalized groups that, armed with this new tool, a relatively simple tool, it doesn't take much to file a Freedom of Information request, have been able to, just by virtue of filing these requests, for example, things like government benefits that they never get, that they're supposed to get, subsidies, benefits of various kinds, that disappear on their way from sort of New Delhi to their localities and are siphoned off and never make it to the proper beneficiaries. And so local activists and groups, by starting filing a massive number of requests, sometimes they don't get the information, but they get the benefits that they're owed to, which is what they're after. And so that means that just by virtue of filing this request, it's enough of a deterrent for the bureaucracy to change ways and make more of these resources available to the people they ought to get to. It's not to say that in 10 years corruption has been eradicated in any part of or India or other parts of the world for that matter. But it is a tool of empowerment. There are many stories. I mean, another story that I like to talk about is a group in Slovakia that has developed a very sophisticated system, including using some cool software to do network analysis. So collect information from private sources, often using freedom of information requests, or public sources, as well as freedom of information requests, vehicle registration, property, real estate registration, to try and build a network and a database about the assets of and the interest of government officials. And so in running this kind of network analysis, they're able to find odd things. You know, for example, sometimes a minister will have nothing under his or her name, but then the wife will be the chair of 12 companies and the brother-in-law will have the titles to 20 houses. And so they're able to use this database to figure out where things may be going wrong.
Right. In Europe, you talked about the end of communism being one of the factors which led to the proliferation of mm-hmm. right to know, right to information legislation, laws. What's the overall picture in Europe, compared to Latin America?
Right. Well, it is a similar picture. And in a way, Europe started early because, as I said, in the early 90s, almost every single one of the new democracies, the former Eastern Bloc countries, has had a new freedom of information law. Not all of them are strong and actively used by the population, but they're very good examples. I mean, the Bulgarians have a good law and made a very good use of it. Estonia has a good law. So what's happened then is that in a way you have this sort of interesting dichotomy. In a way, the new laws of Eastern Europe are better and they're better used than the old laws of the sort of older, more established European democracies in the West. So that's been very, very interesting to watch. There's been a huge amount of litigation in a lot of places in Eastern Europe. But at the international level, of course, the European Court of Human Rights and its system is the sort of the most developed, the most advanced that we have. But for a number of reasons, the way the jurisprudence that has developed, the European Court was originally a little bit more cautious in its approach than the Inter-American Court. And, you know, there's some jurisprudential reasons for that. There's a sense that, well, is this right really in the convention? The structure of the relevant provisions in the two treaties is slightly different. For example, both the Universal Declaration and the American Convention include a single word that seems to make some difference, the right to seek information. In addition to receive and impart. And that word seek is not there in Article 10 of the European Convention. And so they may have had something to do or a sense that it was not meant to be there when it was originally drafted. On the other hand, the European Court has always maintained that, the convention is, of course, what they call a living organism. It's a living treaty and has to adapt to changing circumstances. And so after a certain slow start, a couple of years ago, we also had a major change, sort of a watershed judgment in the European system in a case against Hungary, in which the court held that non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, and the media also have, as in the Inter-American system, a fundamental right to request and obtain information held by the government that is of general interest, of course, with exceptions. But they did establish this principle. And there's with an interesting argument, what the court said in that case, this was about obtaining some submissions to the Constitutional Court of Hungary. And what the court said in that case, when the government, especially when the government is an information monopoly, they hold some information that no one else does, as is typically the case. I mean, of course, the government holds some information that is in the public domain, but what we're most interested in is information that only the government has. And so the court said, when you have that kind of information monopoly over information that is collected and maintained and used using taxpayer money, for the government not to release it to the public is like some form of censorship, because they're taking that information out of the public domain where it duly belongs, and they are denying the watchdogs, the general public, the ability to see what the government is up to. So that's been pretty major. And
was that major because it was giving that right to those institutions rather than to individuals, or it wasn't there at all before?
Well, it wasn't really recognized as explicitly. It was recognized in only limited circumstances before the Hungarian judgment that is known as Tarzazag, which is the Hungarian name for the, or part of the Hungarian name for the Hungarian Civil Liberties Union, which was the organization that brought the case. What was made in the past, the court has said, you have a right to request information from the government if you're somehow personally affected. For example, there was an Italian case called Guerra, in which the applicants were living near a chemical factory using a dangerous material. And the government had even failed to provide minimal information about what was happening in that establishment and what would be the how they might be affected in a case of an incident. So it was a question of what they call private and family life in Strasbourg.
You could get poisoned by that chemical plant.
So you'd be very affected personally. The government said that not having that information made it very difficult for those affected in the vicinity to plan their life, to decide if they want to live there or move somewhere else, how to protect their children. But that was limiting because most people, a lot of people request information and use FOI laws.
But a newspaper in a neighboring town that was worried about that chemical plant wouldn't necessarily have been able to get the information because it wasn't directly affected.
Indeed.
Right.
Indeed. Or if it's something of a more of a what's known as a diffuse interest, for example, corruption affects everyone in a way, but no one really quite directly and personally. But of course, a matter of huge public and democratic interest. So what the court said in the Hungarian case is it doesn't have to be a personal interest anymore. And then 2 months later, in a second Hungarian case known as Kennedy, so one question raised by Tarzazag was, so is this a right just for watchdogs, for organized groups? Can anyone file a request? And then in Kennedy, the court went some way towards answering that question by recognizing that an academic, a researcher, an individual researcher who was looking into sort of historical matters of related to Secret Service activities was also entitled to the same kind of right to request and obtain information, historical information from the Hungarian Secret Service that had been denied to him. And so that the court went from recognizing the right for watchdogs and the media to recognizing it for an individual researcher. And even though they haven't had a specific case involving just a regular individual, it is very hard to see the court denying that because just the plain language of Article 10 says everyone has the right to receive and impart information and ideas.
Not just historians.
Sure.
Right.
So in a way, we're all, activists and can potentially be activists and contributing to a public debate, and we're all equally entitled to do that.
So we've talked about right to know, right to information and environment and also corruption. What about national security? Because that's clearly an area where governments most closely hold information. And there's been a lot of attention over the WikiLeaks case and Bradley Manning and sure. right to information request in the U.S. used to get information on the war on terror. How does the law stand across the various jurisdictions? It's a big question, but
right. Well, there's some aspects to that we can can talk about here, but of course, traditionally, national security represents a major challenge because, in a way, if one has to have secrets, that would be one of the areas where one legitimately has to have some. But of course, for precisely the same reasons, has also been historically one rationale for secrecy that has been horribly abused because it's so easy to invoke it, and sort of it's more difficult for people to stand up and challenge that. In a way, it's a vicious circle because as they say, there's things we know, there's things we don't know, and then there's things we don't know.
Right.
So say it's got a self-perpetuating aspect to it, and that's why it's so important to try and limit what can be done in the name of national security, including in terms of refusing to disclose information. And when one area where that is particularly acute is information about gross or particularly serious human rights violations. Because national security is often a threat, not just to right to know, it's to human rights generally, and things are done in the name of national security to trample upon basic rights. And so it is what we're trying to establish, what many groups have been trying to establish, is this principle that national security cannot be invoked to cover up abuses, other rights abuses, be they crimes against humanity or just the torturing of a single individual in one particular context. And that has developed into what's known as the right to the truth doctrine. It again originated in the Inter-American system because there were a whole range of cases that started coming up to the Inter-American system from the context of the military dictatorships of the 60s and 70s in Latin America, and the massive, really in many countries, massive abuses. And so what the Inter-American Commission, the court, developed was this doctrine that these people are entitled to justice, of course, to their perpetrators being found and punished, but they're also equally importantly entitled to truth, just knowing what happened. And the context was one of massive disappearances when people disappear, were taken off the streets by plainclothes police, never to be seen again. And of course, with a huge psychological and mental torment on the family members, their friends, and a sense of terror generally. And so that was a very important element, the truth component of the accountability process, where countries would be required first and foremost to tell the victims and the general public what happened, who did what to whom, where the bodies were they thrown in the ocean or in some mass grave somewhere. And that is now come to be considered as an important remedy in itself, just knowing what happened to your relatives. And sadly, we have had echoes of that in the post 9/11 world and the global war on terror, where again, whether in good or in bad faith, the anti-terrorism effort has been used and abused in ways that trample upon fundamental rights. We've seen the extraordinary rendition program of secret transfers of detainees. We've seen what we euphemistically call enhanced interrogation techniques which often amount to torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, all done in secrecy. For example, we did not even know that there was an extraordinary rendition program until, you know, the Washington Post and the Der Spiegels of the world started digging into it and publishing the first stories, which forced then President Bush to come out publicly and acknowledge it. And one element of all these effort to try and figure out just what happened is that remarkably and sadly, we have not had much justice or accountability in this country for the abuses. For example, not a single person, not a single a CIA person has been held accountable. There's been deaths in custody. I think, and treatment of detainees that would be perhaps unimaginable before 9/11, and we haven't had any accountability. But at least we've had some truth, certainly not the whole picture. But groups in the U.S. and in Europe have used, in a way, the freedom of information work has been more successful than any other efforts because the courts have blocked efforts at justice and accountability. But at least through the freedom of information work, for example, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, was able to obtain a significant amount of information about the treatment of detainees. It was, of course, redacted. It was not complete, but it was still a massive contribution to what we know about what happened, the policy discussions inside the Bush administration about the treatment of detainees and the actual treatment.
Darian Pavli is a senior attorney for the Open Society Justice Initiative. His focus is on freedom of information and expression issues. You're listening to Law Talks, the podcast about international human rights law. Law Talks is produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative of the Open Society Foundations. To learn more about the initiative's work in international human rights, please visit justiceinitiative.org. That's justiceinitiative.org. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Thanks for listening.